Well, I'm glad everybody didn't really want lunch, or those of you who did didn't get dragged to jail for mugging people that are in your way. I notice you have to get somewhere to get food. I had to dash myself. Anyway, so thanks for coming. It's nice of you to show. We'll carry on and we'll ask some questions as we go. I would like to talk about a piece of something that I think many of us would know, but yet somehow we've overlooked or underutilized, maybe that's the right way to put it, the utility and the relevance of morphology and its relationship to water and landscapes. That combination is something that we know a fair bit about, but it's interesting because I'm kind of in a bit of a fog zone because I've just spent the entire morning around modelers and big data people, and you know the last thing they want to do is go waste their time getting in the field and looking at stuff in the real world because the database is in front of them on their monitors ever so much more enticing. But I would submit that the two are necessary and they go hand in hand and they have to inform one another. So anyway, so let's carry on. So what about this? So I want to talk a little bit about soil systems and as a two-way street from the standpoint of using soil morphology to predict or inform our understanding of water flow through landscapes and going the other way, using landscapes to predict and speak about or anticipate and predict morphology. So what do we mean? There are a couple of underlying notions here that I think help each other reinforce one another. There's this constant interplay between geomorphology, and by that I mean mostly the topography, the lay of the land, and the processes of and content of that landscape. The second part is the geo and the pedostratigraphy, and those are not the same, which really determine the internal architecture of what's possible to work with. If you build a bungalow, you can't very well work on a high-rise apartment. So that aspect is important. And the hydrology course is the dynamic aspect with its emphasis on water dynamics. And I'll include climate within that as well. And then the pedology, which is the net result of and the interactor of with these other parameters, and vegetation, which is there, but I'm not going to deal with it because I got enough to carry on with anyway. So that's the gist. So let's talk about soil landscape models for a moment. Our understanding of soil landscapes from a conceptual standpoint can be far-reaching, and it always involves this, which is good. But when we get down to real business and brass tacks, it always comes back to pedon data or point data. And I'll use those two interchangeably if you'll bear with me. So pedon data in this context really does constitute or represent single point data, especially along a traverse or across a landscape. And hopefully that pedon data is a member along a catenary gradient or sequence. But oftentimes, as we know, they're not. They can be rather randomly selected. And many of the big data modelers prefer that route because, of course, grand statistics tells us that if it's not utterly random, then it can't be real. And that sells short what we know about landscape relationships and soil patterns and ecosystems. So, So anyway, point data. Another point here are catenas. Because what? If you have a catenary gradient, if you have a catena that you're paying attention to, they can be used to parlay into getting point data extrapolated up to areas, not just linear but lateral. And as such, can be used to evaluate watersheds or to summarize larger areas. So it's moving from pedon data up to area data. And that's particularly potent when we're trying to understand about water movement through soilscapes or landscapes because oftentimes we get our measurements at point data scale, but what we're really after is what's going on nearby. So, okay. And catenas also help us get a handle, if we're wise, on topo sequences and hydro sequences, which really is a way of speaking about how soil bodies and processes relate to their neighbors. So, last point, soil systems themselves. Soil systems are collections of dominant catenas of a given area, and so they're catena-based. And they're a good way, I think they're an effective way to link soil processes and properties and water flow on a broader scale. And again, give us a way to summarize entire settings. So that's kind of where I want to go with this. But a couple of quick points here about soil systems. We believe that they provide a critical link between soil point data and ecosystem processes of areas. And if you pay attention to the modeling that's going on, everybody, that's the holy grail. How do we move effectively and legitimately up and down scales? How do we go from the big stuff to the small and the small stuff to the big? And I would submit to you that soil systems and soil information in general fits in that sweet spot between the molecular and the grand scale stuff. And it's something that the big scale modelers are still struggling with. If you take a review of some of the symposia this week, you're going to see that struggle going on and being explored. So an opportunity not to be missed. So another point is that the soil systems provide quantifiable framework to hang data upon, and I think that they make models much more robust and give it scalar reliability when that's an ingredient of what you how you structure your studies and your information delivery. It also serves to integrate hydropedology in a tangible way. If we can accept the notion that the water is the blood of the earth, and I think it is, then follow the water. If you follow the water, many things become comprehensible. And lastly, the soil system provide conceptual models to communicate information to audiences that have a harder time accessing or understanding what we talk about in the clergy. Okay, so back to the point data. This is the kind of a representation of a classic Pennon scale box, 1 by 1 meter, 2 meters deep. And it's just a representation of the idea. This is what we go after. When we talk about soil data, and that's almost anybody in any study, that's the scale of which our data is actually quantifiably extracted and derived. That's the scale we work at. And if we pick a representative site, like this box is, you know, you could move the box in any direction, and you're more or less, there's some local variability, but it's more or less the same beast. So, okay, so that's a good representation of that area. But what that doesn't do is, what it doesn't do is doesn't tell you about its neighbors. And that little box there is what the previous box was. And all as accurate and as precise as we can be about that point data, and we can be, does that point data inform us about this entire landscape and how things vary? And where they vary, in what direction do they vary? What's the magnitude? What's the direction? And the answer is, it doesn't. We try to stretch it and make it do so, and there are ways that we can legitimately stretch it, but you have to know the broader context. So catenas, and in the broader sense and three-dimensionality, soil systems will help get you there. So the premise I have here for you is that one is to recognize the hydropedology through soil morphology to infer dominant internal water flow direction, and two, kind of going the other direction, recognize the landscape and climate dynamics to infer dominant internal water flow through the landscape. So it's kind of going from the small scale, you're going both directions, big down and down up to big. So if you think, remember just, and this is very generalized, painfully so, but it gives the general idea. There are some solubility differences in some of the constituents that we commonly deal with in soils, and we're all familiar with this, right? And just as a point, carbonates tend to be more soluble than the sulfates, excuse me, less soluble than the sulfate, than the gypsum, and then which is less soluble than the sodium chloride, right? Solubilities are not the same across the soil spectrum species. mineral species. So what do we have? Compound species. So here we go. Let's look at a case in point. What am I talking about? Here's a lovely landscape that's got all kinds of topographic variety for you. It's out in the western Great Plains. You're looking at a tableland area in western Nebraska. And you're looking at a landscape that has less overtopping alluvium shed off the Great Rocky Mountain front, the Ogallala Formation. And there's not a lot of variety out there, right? But if you go across that surface, you do occasionally find some topographic variation. In this case, here's a closed depression. And how many of you were at Doug Wysocki's presentation this morning? A couple. Okay. Then you guys can rest, because you're going to see some of the same. But anyway, here's a closed depression out there on that tableland. And let's go play with it a little bit and see what can we say about it in terms of its anticipated morphology. Or, going the other way, what can the morphology tell us about water flow through that landscape? So here's the bird's eye view, your web soil survey type content. And you're seeing polygons, and the numbers mean nothing, and that's fine. But what we're going to do, in effect, is we're going to look at this point here, just because it's one of the members in that landscape system. And we've got a whole series of soil types coming down here. And we're going to just look at the one. And there's your profile. And my question is what is it? And what does that tell you? What does morphology tell you about water flow? Well, you don't know, because you can see some things, but you don't know what the composition is. I will tell you a little bit more information by saying, okay, if you look up here, you see some white thread features here, right? And those are concentrations, and that happens to be gypsum. In contrast, this off-white zone down over here is enriched with calcium carbonate. So if that's true, we can assign grossly these kinds of horizonation assignments. Holy crap. Sorry. How do we do this? Then the question is where's the water go? Right? Time making the connection between water flow. Based on the morphology, we know that the carbonates are less soluble than the gypsum. So that the morphology of that profile tells us that the water has to be coming up. I don't know anything about that soil. I've never been there before, but that's what that tells me. It has to be so. Now, if we put that, and this is that profile right here. If we put that into a landscape, a simple landscape model, we are looking at a series of soils, and they have similar compositions for the most part. This alliance soil up here has a deep surface horizon down to a calcium carbonate enrichment. The key soil is a sort of a truncated profile, again, with carbonates enriched at its base. And then we come over to here to this beast. So, and we also have out in the center of this depression, we have this soil that has a thick argillic horizon, no salts, no gypsum, no carbonates at all. How do you make any sense out of that? Well, you can. You can use that to infer the dominant water flow, because what do you have? You have, these are recharged profiles, these two. They have to be. You've got carbonate down below. It's been leached out of calcareous lust deposits up above, and it's concentrating down below. So there has to be a dominant downward component. In contrast, you get over here, and it's coming back up to the surface, because we already said the morphology tells us the water's coming up with the carbonates below the gypsum. And if there were sodium chloride in the system, that would be up at the top. It doesn't happen to be in the system. And the lodgepole has got to be a recharge site. So we can use the morphology to reconstruct what's going on with the water flow. And there's from the landscape, going from the big picture down, we know that in human environments, the water tables mimic the surface topography. The water tables mimic the landscape surface. In arid areas, it's the opposite. And in between, you get things that bounce back and forth. I don't know why I died. But the point is that if you know where you are climatically, you can make an educated guess on where the dominant flow direction is going to be through that landscape, and you can go from there to say, what might I expect in different settings? With salts and things in the West, it's a little easier because you have more species, mineral species or compounds that help you track the water flow. But in the humid East, you have fewer but different ones, and I would submit to you that you have iron and manganese. If you've got manganese shots concentrations here below this surface layer, and you've got iron concentrations below, which way is the water going? Based on what you know about solubility in very general terms. The manganese is more soluble than the iron compound, so the water in that profile has got to be coming up. So really what you're talking about in a sense is PETO liquid chromatography. So that's it. That's my pitch. We're done. Anybody else? Anybody got questions?
We are out of time.
Sorry,
but
thank you.
No problem.
Okay.
I wasn't sure how that alarm would work. Hope that
it works well.
But great resource, great presentation. I'll allow one question if there's a burning question. Otherwise, please talk to Philip afterwards and continue the conversation.